We all love them, but are electronic devices killing us?
These are the things that many people have been studying now, the epidemiology of cell phone exposure, exposure to all kinds of EMF, have shown that there is an increased risk of development of cancers.
That's Martin Blank. His book is Overpowered: The Dangers of Electromagnetic Radiation and What You Can Do About It. And Argentina teeters on the brink of default because of hedge fund vultures like Paul Singer, who buy up national debt for pennies on the dollar and then demand payment in full. Today we re-air our 2011 interview with investigative journalist Greg Palast about his book, Vulture's Picnic. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rianna. Since reading Martin Blank's book, Overpowered, my cell phone feels less like a love object and more like a cross between a cobra and a dangerous addictive drug. And it's not just the phone. I've moved my clock radio across the room from my bed. I switch my Wi-Fi off every night. And when I use my microwave, more sparingly than before, I exile myself from the kitchen until it's done its job. That's because Blank's a scientist, and he's an expert in the effects of electromagnetic radiation on cells. And those effects are not benign. He considers the proliferation in our environment of electric and magnetic field radiation, or EMFs, from the myriad of electronic devices we surround ourselves with, to be the largest uncontrolled biological experiment on human beings ever. In Overpowered, he says the evidence is accumulating that links EMFs to rising rates of certain brain and head cancers, Alzheimer's disease, and even possibly autism. It's not a welcome message to most of us.
I know how people feel. I mean, I feel that way about my computer. And while I talk about the dangers of Wi-Fi, for example, I always tell people whenever there's a conversation of this sort, I always tell them, shut your Wi-Fi off when you're not using it. Most people just keep the thing on. It's just an easy tendency when you've switched something on to just leave it there and you forget about it. But when it's there, it's affecting you. It's always on and it's always affecting the cells, and they're responding.
You call the whole development of these electromagnetic devices and electrical devices that we use the largest biological experiment ever. So, you know, kind of give us the overview. What are some of the effects? And talk also about kind of the dose-response relationship, you know, that they can even be effects at low doses.
Let me first start by getting the overall picture. That is, if you asked me this question, if we were both around then 150 years ago, this question couldn't be asked because there were no, this non-ionizing radiation that is all over the place now, just wasn't here. We had some radiation of this sort that came from the sun, relatively little. There was some natural radiation of this very low frequency that was due to the electrical storms on the Earth, the lightning that comes, that goes through the atmosphere, gets shunted around the world, and we get little bits of it. But we don't have that. And we grow on the Earth in a DC magnetic field, in other words, a magnetic field that's really not changing. It's pretty constant. That's why birds and fish can use this for navigating. And so this just wasn't around. But now, ever since the light bulb came in and power lines to fuel that, and the various appliances, and then radio and television and microwave ovens and cell phones and smart meters, my God, it's an endless list, and it's growing. So that we've got this environment now that we're living in that's just chock full of all this electromagnetic radiation. And the thing is that we're not designed. I say we were designed by Mother Nature through evolution to live in an environment that is the Earth of 150 years ago. That's how people have developed. And now, in the last 150 years, we've got these new influences that are beginning to change the way people are living. For example, there are people who are so sensitive to these electromagnetic fields in the environment that they cannot tolerate the levels that most people and the majority of people find that they can live in, that they don't respond to it, or at least they don't think they're responding to it. Although there's been a big increase in people who have problems sleeping, for example, and all kinds of other so-called psychological, psychiatric kinds of symptoms. So we don't really know the full extent of what's happening, but we do know that there are people who are extremely sensitive to these changes, and that number is growing.
Yeah, I was interested to hear that because for a while I've been feeling that my hands just, they feel prickly when I use the computer trackpad. And after reading your book, I actually just turned off the Wi-Fi on my laptop, and it seemed, the prickliness seemed to go away. So I thought maybe it wasn't the trackpad, it was the Wi-Fi and the trackpad together. Is that a possibility?
It certainly is, and you're the best judge of it. I mean, obviously, there's a psychological component. I mean, people can sometimes make themselves feel certain things and ignore other things. But there's no doubt about the fact these are the experiments that we've done. We've done experiments on cells, and cells don't simulate answers and are not psychologically influenced the same way people are. But the fact is that experiments on cells have shown that they give the similar responses to electromagnetic frequencies all along the non-ionizing spectrum. We found that cells respond to these fields in a very protective mode. The cells respond to all kinds of dangers, or virtually all kinds of dangers, by making special proteins that help to correct the damage that's done by many of these influences. And these are called stress proteins. There are about 20 of them. And they're made when cells, for example, are exposed to a high acidity or low acidity, low oxygen. Temperature is another one, and all kinds of EMF. We studied it in the power frequency range. We've also done experiments in the radio frequency range. Many others have since done a lot of experiments to show this. And these same proteins are made by the cells over the wide range of frequencies. So that's a first indication that the cell, first of all, has its own way of dealing with problems, and they deal with a whole variety of problems in a very similar way, because these are problems that interfere with the normal functioning of the cell. It'll affect things like the DNA. In fact, one of the early experiments that was done was shown that exposure to levels of EMF that are considered safe can cause DNA damage. And DNA damage, of course, is the stuff that leads to mutations, and that can lead to mutations, and that is believed to be the origin of cancers. And these are the things that many people have been studying now, the epidemiology of cell phone exposure to all kinds of EMF, have shown that there is an increased risk of development of cancers, especially in connection with things like cell phones. There have been brain tumors have been shown to increase.
And yeah, there's been a huge rise in these, what are they called,
glioblastoma.
Yes, glioblastoma, with a lot of young people getting them.
Even meningiomas, which are a different kind of... But a more interesting experiment, at least from a scientific point of view, although it's relatively low incidence, is the cancer incidence in salivary glands. You know, the glands that secrete the saliva that starts the digestion process in the mouth. And it's been found that there's been an increase in salivary gland tumors as a result of exposure to, well, let me put it that, coincident with the increase in cell phone use. And the experiments that have been done have measured the cancers in a number of different salivary glands. The salivary gland, the parotid gland, which is closest to the cell phone antenna, has increased, and rather markedly, since cell phone use came in. But the submandibular gland, which sits below the jawbone, has remained pretty steady. It's a small incidence, and it hasn't increased as the parotid tumor has. And that is a pretty good, almost like a control experiment, where the gland that's shielded to some extent, or to a large extent in this case, from the radiation, does not get affected, whereas the one that's more exposed does show an increased risk of cancer.
Well, there are a couple of things in what you said that I think are interesting. I mean, for one thing, we're not talking about great distances in terms of safety. I mean, even a small change in distance can be protective. Isn't that right?
Yes, definitely. But when you talk about distance, if you read the fine print in the little brochure that comes with your cell phone, you'll notice that I think most of them have something like you should keep the phone a half inch to an inch away from your body when you're using it. It's there in the small print. That is the measurement that they make to bring it below the level that's currently considered safe. I should say it's considered safe, it's ruled to be safe, but biologically it's not very much safer than being very close to it. And the reason I'll tell you that is when the body develops these stress proteins, which are the biological reaction to all kinds of harmful stimuli that affect cells, these are stimulated at very, very low levels. And they are stimulated in the power frequency range, which is far less energetic than the radio frequency range, microwave range, that's used in cell phones. So that there's no question that the cells are telling us that they are invoking their first aid. They find this stuff bad for the cell, and they're starting to make chemicals that will help correct the damage that's being done.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Martin Blank, retired cell biologist, about the dangers of cell phones, microwaves, and other devices that emit electromagnetic radiation. His book is called Overpowered.
So the list of problems that are could be caused by these, I mean, first of all, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, this is a hugely controversial subject. There have been many, many studies, both those that have shown problems and others that haven't shown problems. Talk a little bit about the controversy. I believe that, you know, for example, the IEEE organization came out against a report, an organization that you're associated with, a report that called the Bioinitiative Report. You were a past president of the organization that put it out, got very roundly criticized. What were the criticisms that were being made, and how do you answer them?
Let me first point out the Bioinitiative Report is an independent report put out by scientists. It originated at the Bioelectromagnetic Society Symposium. I happen to have been a president of that organization, and was involved in getting this symposium started, but it's not associated with the organization. It's a grassroots group of scientists who were stimulated as a result of this symposium to bring the facts before the scientists as well as before the public. And by putting it online, it has been available to the public, and it has the information about these effects written by the scientists who did the studies. One thing I'll say for certain is that many of the people who are making these judgments that are being used to question the conclusions of the Bioinitiative Report are not biologists. They may be engineers, they may be good scientists, but they're not biologists, because if they knew the biology, they would know what the cells are doing to react to these kinds of stimuli, and that they don't react to them as being friendly. Now, one of the main criticisms that's been made is that the Bioinitiative is one-sided. I don't know what one-sided means. When you present the biology, that's biology. It's a bioinitiative that was focused on the biology, and the biology is unequivocal. There are experiments in which some of the results are different. For example, one of the classic results was a paper done by Henry Lai and Narendra Singh showing that levels of low-frequency EMF, that power frequency, can cause DNA to fragment, that little pieces come off it. So they published this result, and there was a big to-do. They say, well, it's not correct. Somebody else did another study and showed that exposure at that frequency and at that level did not cause fragmentation. And that's often quoted as saying that the first paper is not correct. The answer is that they chose a very different cell, and some cells are stronger than others, and all you need is some cells to break apart, for the DNA to break apart. And that result has stood the test of time. Many people have been able to repeat it, and those who are the deniers, I don't think they're capable of judging these kinds of results if they consistently deny their validity. So what I'm saying is that there are many ways in which results are skewed. Experiments are set up to try and give a different kind of conclusion, or to give a kind of conclusion that you started with that you were looking for. This is especially true in epidemiology studies. For example, one of the studies set up in Denmark where they said that we want to make sure that the people who are using cell phones are actually using. So they took people who had registered as using cell phones by a certain date, and they were users. And then anybody who got a cell phone after that date and registered was counted as a non-user. Can you imagine when they collected all the data how the two were intermixed, and you got many users in the wrong category, and they were counted as non-users? And so you end up with results that make no sense at all, because they've been screwed around with to the point where any result that could have been gotten was obscured. So these are the kinds of things that happen. So there's so much that's going on with the manipulation. But one thing is certain. There are things that people should know have been seen in many labs, and that are quite clear. This should interest many men who are in the habit of taking their cell phones and putting them in their pockets. When you put the cell phone in your pocket, you may think that it's away, it's not near your head. But, of course, it's near the lower part of your body where your reproductive organs are located. And this problem has shown up in fertility clinics, where there's a direct correlation between the cell phone usage and the sperm count and sperm quality. In other words, sperms can change their shape, the tails can get distorted, and of course that usually leads to problems in fertilization. So that there are now many reports of decreases in fertility as a result of men keeping cell phones in their pockets. There's an easy solution to that. When you put your cell phone in your pocket, before you do, shut the power off. But everybody is reluctant to miss a call. The problem is that the cell phone is not off when it's in your pocket. It is sending signals out to the tower to let the tower know where you are so that it can send you a call as soon as it comes in. So you are getting irradiated pretty regularly. So that's an easy one. Shut the power off.
Might there be some ways to create devices that are better shielded? You know, if there are devices that we do absolutely need, and of course there are many that people are not going to stop using, like cell phones and microwaves.
Well, the microwave, I'm not sure people are all that wedded to it. I mean, the microwave may have a certain amount of convenience, but if you're interested in food that tastes like food, you want to cook it the old-fashioned way.
I think probably most people use them for reheating. But the point I was trying to make was, is there a way to work on creating safer products that are better shielded?
Well, the microwave oven, when it leaves the factory, the microwave compartment is apparently okay, but apparently after opening and closing that door many times, there's leakage, and people are advised to have that checked just to make sure they're not leaking that into the kitchen. The other thing is that microwave ovens have a microwave part, and they also have a pack that is taking the power and converting it into the microwave frequency. And so that's the part that's radiating ELF, and that too is a problem. In other words, if you're too close to the machine, you may also be getting the exposure to that kind of EMF. And I think it all adds up. The body doesn't have a device that will determine which frequencies are coming in. It's reacting to all the frequencies that it's capable of reacting to. And that's the problem. Every device that's rated is rated individually. But you are using a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, sitting in front of your computer, you got a computer there, but you also have a printer, you have a scanner, you may have other things sitting there that are also electrical, including a light. So these all add up. And some people are more vulnerable to these effects than others. So you've got to realize what your individual capabilities are and try and adjust your exposure so that it doesn't exceed them.
talking about some people more vulnerable, you make the point in your book, Martin Blank, you make the point in Overpowered, that children are at much greater risk. And the risk is now developing even in the womb. Talk about children and some of the ways in which they're at greater risk.
People started, it was about 10, 15 years ago, people were interested in the effects of these electrically heated water beds and blankets and so on. And studies were done that found that there was an increase in miscarriage as a result of exposure. And this was published and all. But Dr. Lee from Kaiser Permanente and his colleagues did a study, a follow-up of children who were born, and found that these are children now that are about 10, 12 years old, and that there's double the risk of obesity and autism, I think the other thing, that when you've got these children are in utero, they are subject to the same kind of effects and probably much more damaging, because whatever happens in utero is happening to a developing organism that where all the cells are going to proliferate. And so if you get a damage in one cell, it's going to become the parent of lots of other cells as the child grows up. So you've got this increased damage that's finding its way through life. And I think that this is pretty strong warning for people to try and avoid exposure of children, infants, and fetuses and embryos that you want to keep as unexposed as you possibly can.
So you're quite wedded to some of your electronic and electrical devices. What are some of the things that people can do? I mean, you talked about turning off the Wi-Fi. What about hands-free phones? For example, I don't generally put my phone up to my ear. I'll use earphones that are connected to it. I'll use a headset in that way. But I'm not so sure that that's safe either. So talk about some of the things that people can do to lower their risk.
I think one of the most important things is to identify where there is a risk. Unfortunately, we don't have sensors that will pick this stuff up and give us the information. In other words, if it were something that were emitting light, we could find it, or emitting a sound, we could find it. But most people have to rely on meters. And there are meters that are available, and if you find, you can get one that will enable you to make the measurements if you suspect something, and then therefore be able to isolate it and get away from it. In the book, I recommend one that I found quite useful. It's a these portable radios, AM/FM radios. You hold them in the palm of your hand, and there's usually an antenna on it. And if you turn it on and turn the tuning dial, to either end of the frequency band that you've got there, the AM band and the FM band, they have a low and a high. If you get beyond the band where they're broadcasting, all you get is static. Well, just raise the volume on that static till you're getting a good static sound, and then go around with that. And when you pick up more static, you are picking up radio frequency signals. I use that for devices that I suspect. And if you hold the antenna close to the device and move it away, and the level of static changes, then you've got yourself a detector, at least of something, that's emitting radio frequency signals. And if you want, you can try both ends of the AM dial and both ends of the FM dial, which will give you a range of radio frequency. And that's better than nothing. And since you probably have a device like that at home, you don't have to go out and purchase a new one. This is just enough to give you the information that it's there and that it's emitting. And that's usually sufficient, because if it's an emitter, then you will be able to stay away from it. And that's all you really want to do.
You know, we're just at the beginning of the electromagnetic age. They're talking now about putting RFID-type things almost in everything. This is just happening everywhere. People are using smart devices that they're wired up to tell them how well they sleep, and, their exercise and their diet. We are the wired generation. How do you see being able to control or regulate this When you have probably almost every industry sector wanting to look the other way?
I really don't know. If you could look at me, I'm throwing my hands up in despair.
Talk a little bit about the regulatory outlook. I know that the EU, for example, has adopted the general principle called the precautionary principle with respect to many kinds of environmental contaminants and pollution of different kinds. This is where they say that we're not going to wait until all the proof is in. There's a reasonable suspicion that something may be harmful. We are going to control it. But they haven't done this, as far as I know, about EMFs. And there's a whole lot of countries, including our own, that don't take that attitude.
Well, first let me say the precautionary principle is not quite pie in the sky. There's a monetary component to it, that if the cost of intervention is less than the presumed cost to rectify the damage that is done, then you take the action. But if the precautionary action is so expensive, then you delay it. You don't do it. And I think that's an important part, because it introduces a very realistic component in the assessment of what options are available to society.
So what kind of regulation do you think is necessary if it was to follow the precautionary principle? What would you recommend?
First of all, I think it's very important that people become aware of these things. And one of the things that should be done is that there should be labeling of devices, so that people become aware of the fact that these things are emitting even though they can't measure them. So once there's an awareness, I think people will start to say, well, let's see, we can reduce our exposure to these kinds of things, because the most exposure is not helpful. I know in my book, I have a chapter on health effects. I think it's important that people inform themselves, and people always get caught up in the technicalities. And I think this, by the way, is helping those who are trying to confuse the public by introducing all these technical terms for electromagnetic fields and various frequency ranges. The different ranges, the ionizing, non-ionizing radiation, low frequency, microwave, all that, these are divisions that were arbitrarily set up by humans and not by nature. And the divisions, such as they exist, are arbitrary. And when one is trying to say that something is safe up to a certain frequency, and then beyond that you can't raise it a certain level, this is just, say, fabrication. And if people believe it, then they should realize that it's not based on anything real. And I think one of the big problems is that there are not enough biologists involved in setting the standards, because the safety standards that are set have not taken the biology into consideration.
And, well, I think you make the point also in the book that very low levels of EMF have been shown to have an impact on the neurology, and even could be implicated in the increases in Alzheimer's and Lou Gehrig's disease. And that's at low levels. Is that right?
Very low. There was a big study that was done in Switzerland where they did practically the whole population. They had the data for the fields that people are exposed to from power lines. And I don't remember what it was. People who lived within 50 meters of a power line, the risk of Alzheimer's was far greater than those who lived a long distance from the power lines. And this was over virtually the entire population, you might say. And the other thing that study showed is that the risk increased for the number of years you resided there. So if it were 5 years, it was one level, and then at 10 years, it was greater, and 15 years was still greater. And so that's a pretty strong indication that there is a risk associated with exposure, and that the risk is at a relatively low level. This is below radio frequency. And yet this is you see that the long-term exposure is going to have its effects on the nervous system.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It would go a long way towards educating the public. The book is Overpowered, and I've been speaking with the author, Martin Blank. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
Martin Blank. His book is Overpowered: The Dangers of Electromagnetic Radiation and What You Can Do About It. He's a retired professor from Columbia University. Next up, Greg Palast talks about vultures, the kind that live on Wall Street and scavenge debt. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. At the end of July, the federal court in Manhattan ruled against Argentina in its debt dispute with hedge fund owner Paul Singer. Singer's firm bought up a portion of Argentina's debt for pennies on the dollar and is demanding to be paid 100% of the original value. Other debt holders have agreed to take less, but Argentina isn't allowed to settle those debts until it pays Singer off. Singer is a so-called vulture capitalist, and he, along with others of his ilk, are the subject of investigative reporter Greg Palast's book, Vulture Picnic. I interviewed Palast in 2011. Greg Palast is a Sam Spade of investigative reporting. Like his hero, Raymond Chandler's character Philip Marlowe, Palast is the consummate gumshoe, staking out his targets while freezing his bleeps off in back alleys in Baku or devising clever ruses to ensnare them in their palatial homes. His targets? BP executives, corrupt rulers of oil-soaked dictatorships, and the financial vultures that scavenge the debts of poor countries, making them even poorer. His new book, Vulture's Picnic, uncovers the connection between predatory finance and dirty energy. Along the way, he reveals the nuclear and oil industry's flagrant disregard for safety. Case in point, BP's Deepwater Horizon disaster, Palast says, wasn't an accident. It was a crime scene. It's gripping and scary reading. Greg Palast does his investigative reporting for BBC Television, The Guardian, and Democracy Now! I sat down with him at an undisclosed location, the place where he and his assistant, the talented and multilingual Miss Badpenny, plan their sleuthing. Well, Greg Palast, thanks so much for welcoming Writer's Voice into your lair here.
It's thrilling to have you here, as a matter of fact, right inside where it's done.
So this book, Vulture's Picnic, this whole story starts when there was a confidential memo that was delivered to your assistant's desk, Miss Badpenny, and this happened during the Deepwater Horizon blowout as that was going on. Tell us what that memo was about.
Yeah, well, that's because this is a real pulp nonfiction, the real thing. Deepwater Horizon explodes. Badpenny, my chief investigator, and I were in Vegas, actually looking, digging into Chevron, and we get a cable from a ship floating in the middle of the Caspian Sea saying, I have the information, I know what's going on, but I can't talk through this IT system. So I set up a secure line to someone floating in the Caspian Sea, which is in the middle of Asia, off the coast of Azerbaijan. If you don't know where the coast of Azerbaijan is, don't worry. When the 82nd Airborne arrives there, you'll figure it out. One of those Islamic republics pooped out by the Soviet Union at the time. So what we are finding is that the answer to the Deepwater Horizon investigation, which I was assigned to cover for British television, prime time, where I work, and we have to work our way into Baku, the capital. It's not easy to get in. We had to use subterfuge, of course, and it's really difficult to get out, especially in my case when I got arrested, when they figured out that I was hunting down what really was going on with BP.
Now, BP and Baku and Deepwater, what's the line here?
Okay, in Vulture's Picnic, it's a series of investigations from Fukushima, financial vultures, Congo, but the core thing I'm looking at is the British Petroleum operations worldwide, in particular, what really happened on the Deepwater Horizon. And one of the things we find out early on in the chapter called Lady Babaland, the Islamic Republic of BP, we find that there was a prior Deepwater explosion, which BP had covered up. It was BP rig, transocean rig, same crappy cement that they used in the Gulf, and it blew out there 2 years before the Deepwater Horizon, and they covered it up. Now, I used to be a racketeering investigator before as an investigative reporter. I can tell you, in the old days, cover-up meant fraud and racketeering. And it changes the Deepwater Horizon disaster from an accident to a homicide because they have covered up the fact they knew that they were using an inherently dangerous method. But how they covered up is very important. We get arrested, cutting across the desert. I'm trying to get to the BP terminal. And they grab my film, which is, of course, the first thing they do when I say they. First BP police, and then the security agencies, and the military police, and they grab us, and we're under arrest. So the first thing, give us your film, right? But yeah, they took the film, but then what they didn't take my pen, which, you know, as a journalist, and what they didn't know and didn't check was that Bad Penny had given me one of those Austin Power jobs that has a camera, a video camera in it. So I got the evidence and came out with the evidence. That wasn't easy either, because they found the pen, by the way, later. It still got out with the evidence that there was a prior explosion, BP had covered it up. And by the way, just so you know, under British law, I had to present all my evidence to BP in London of not only that they had the prior explosion, which they covered up, which they lied to the SEC, they lied to Congress about, but how they covered it up. They covered it up through bribery, massive millions of dollars in bribes, beatings, babes, all the bees in BP. In other words, they actually, Lord Brown, the CEO of BP, flew his private 727 into Baku and had the local officials picked up and flown back to London for lap dancing for the weekend. These cover-ups, this activity, the bribery, which is also against U.S. law, they didn't deny it. And rather, you can see at vulturespicnic.org, where I'm going to have the a lot of these documents, you'll see that BP simply said, we followed all the laws. Now, wait, I said, did you commit bribery? Are there beatings? Did you lie? Did you commit perjury? Did you violate the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of the United States? I mean, these are serious charges. No direct denials of any of it. Mm-hmm. The only thing that they said is, we followed the laws.
So you're basically saying that they already knew prior that the cement would fail. You used to investigate or know about the cleanup technology. Tell us a little bit about this. The booms, for example, that we saw those pictures about. There's also a lot of other stuff in this book, Rick, Palace Vulture's Picnic, about how basically you call it a cleanup theater. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So what, you know, I was the head of the racketeering and fraud investigation of the Exxon Valdez when that blew out 20 years earlier. And I recommended racketeering charges against the oil company, not against Exxon, though I did name them as a co-conspirator. I said the main party responsible for 1,000 miles of destruction of Alaska coastline was British Petroleum, because they, BP, was in charge of preventing spills and cleaning them up. It's not rocket science, which you take a bunch of rubber, you use the technical word boom, but it's just a big, like, rubber. It's you know, put a big rubber around and get these sucker shapes, you suck it out, so rubber suck, and that's it. And it's no big deal, but you have to have the equipment. You have to have the rubber, you have to have the ships, you have to have the equipment, and you have to have people trained. And BP lied about it in Alaska. I mean, lied. They filled out forms in my investigation, which I have. We have them. They filled out documents saying, we will have equipment here. In fact, they said that they were going to have equipment on Bly Island, which is exactly where the Exxon Valdez hit. They were supposed to have all this emergency equipment. It wasn't there because they figured, who's going to check it? A bunch of natives out there, you know, in their kayaks? A bunch of whales? Who cares? And so when the ship hit, the equipment that they said was there wasn't. Same thing in the Gulf. BP and Chevron and Exxon, the whole crew of them, had supposedly hired and set up this big spill response operation, and it was nowhere. I'm looking at that thing go up, and the oil's spreading all over. And by the time Obama declares a national emergency, the oil slick is bigger than the island of Jamaica. And there was no reason for that. None. The Gulf is not a terrible accident zone. It is a crime scene. These are crimes. And this is an investigation. Vulture's Picnic, what I call In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs and Power Pirates and High Finance Carnivores. I'm chasing these guys down, and I'm getting this evidence. You have to know these are crime scenes.
Vultures. Who are the vultures? And what's the connection between the vultures and this whole oil scenario? What's the connection between them and the petroleum pigs?
Vultures are financial speculators. I mean, I can think they're all vultures, but it specifically refers to these billionaires. In fact, the number one donor to the Republican Party is Paul the Vulture Singer. They proudly call themselves vultures. They are people who, speculators, billionaires mostly, who grab a hold of the debts of third world nations, buy them for pennies on the, when they say buy, bribery, blackmail, flim-flam fraud. They get their hands on old pieces of debt owed by nations which have gone through civil wars or whatever that everyone forgot. And they become like international repo men, scavenging for resources of these nations. I just came back from the Congo last week where a vulture from Vulture's Picnic, a guy named Goldfinger, had somehow got himself from the prime minister of Bosnia out the back door some debt owed by Congo to Bosnia, weird thing from like 3 decades ago, or to Yugoslavia, which doesn't exist anymore. He's using that. He seized a hold of all the cobalt that was just shipped from Congo, which was to be used to end the cholera epidemic. So, I mean, these guys are really creepy. Goldfinger and then Paul the Vulture Singer. By the way, I just flew to Bosnia, following up from the book. We find out that the police have found out about Goldfinger and the prime minister, and they've recommended, they've now filed charges against the prime minister to have him, they said he should be arrested, and we're going to put him in jail, okay? Paul the Vulture Singer, you'll see in the book, is he's grabbed the Republic of Congo. He paid a few bucks. Somehow he got his hands on some debt, and he's already hit the Republic of Congo for nearly $500 million. That's everything they have. What's happening is they have oil, for example, in Congo. When they try to ship it, these guys grab it. They're like legalized pirates. And when I say legalized, it's not quite clear. There are outlaws in England. There are outlaws in most of Europe. They're just not outlaws in the USA.
So you're saying they buy the debt of a country for pennies on the dollar from the other country. And then they come in, and if they can't get the cash, they get the oil.
They get the oil. But I want to make clear, in the case of Bosnia, it was a crime. This is a stolen security, and the prime minister is going to end up in prison. In the case of Zambia, it was a $3 million bribe. Bad penny follows the president of Zambia with his $3 million. He's dropping off in a Swiss bank account. She speaks several languages, so she went in speaking French or German. And, you know, doing a reality show, shopping the rich and famous, and asked, will anyone important come in here shopping? Yeah, the president of Zambia, he just dropped $1 million buying 200 pairs of elevator shoes and a diamond studded tie. So we get this stuff. So it's bribery, blackmail, theft, fraud. In the case of Liberia, I'm chasing throughout the book a mysterious group called the Hamsa. Hamsa, if you know, is Arabic for five, and it also means an evil eye and an open hand. And I'm trying to figure out who Hamsa is. And I go to Africa, and I actually warn the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who just got the Nobel Prize, that there's someone corrupt, a finger of the hand in her cabinet. Mm. By the way, she fires her entire cabinet after that. She knows that it's corrupt. Someone's corrupt. Maybe they're all corrupt, but at least one's corrupt. So she fired the entire cabinet to just make sure she got the one. Yeah, these vultures were choking this nation to death. But you have to understand, these are the top funders of the Republican Party. And it's not by the way, they also not exactly ungenerous to the Democrats. It's not these vultures are definitely bipartisan carnivores.
Let's go back to the oil and see if we can weave in some of the vultures here as well. You went to Alaska after you went to Baku. You got a note from the intelligence chief of the Free Republic of the Arctic. This man, he's impressive. Tell us about him, and why did he want you to come there?
Well, the intelligence chief is his intelligence chief, but the chief himself is Etok, who is the leader, the militant leader of the Eskimos of the North Slope of Alaska. And I get this note from the, you know, from the chief of intelligence of the Free Republic of the Arctic. I mean, this is, come on, this is a joke. Where is this from? And it says, come up to Kaktovik right away. Kaktovik. I look on Google Maps. It's a little island above the Arctic Circle in the Beaufort Sea. When it turns out that it's from Etok, who is the famous whale hunter chief of the Eskimo, I do go up. And he brings me, and we go inside a whale carcass, which is, you know, as big as a house, and eat some whale meat, fermented whale meat and congealed blood. And he's making a point. He says, they're trying to drill here, and he wants me to get across to BP and the Queen, where she can stick her oil well. And I said, that's anatomically impossible. But what's tragic is that Obama, just a few months ago, as the book ends, he authorizes drilling right off Kaktovik, which, as far as the natives are concerned, I mean, whales don't swim in oil any more than you or I do, and that's pretty much the end of the Eskimo.
The view that we're getting, that I got in reading this book, Vulture's Picnic, Greg Palast, is that, you know, drilling in the Arctic is really talking, because of the corruption, because of the lies, because of the total lack of safety in any way, shape, or form, we have a lot to fear from drilling in the Arctic as well as drilling from anywhere. And this is really what you're showing in the book.
Well, they couldn't drill in the Gulf, you know, which is pretty easy stuff. Yeah. Okay. These guys, they can drill safely, but that costs money. It's all about the money. They're not in the business of finding oil. They're in the business of finding your money.
So you talk about pigs. I mean, you have petroleum pigs here, but that's a double entendre.
Yes.
Because there's a really chilling, I mean, here we're just gone through this XL pipeline struggle, which is not over, we should say. I mean, they're going to reroute it. We're talking thousands of miles of pipelines. Pigs, tell us what pigs are and why this is also so much of a dangerous part of this lack of safety issue.
Well, when I talk about petroleum pigs in Vulture's Picnic, it's not just the porky bonus bloated executives that get sucked into a pipeline. There is a robot pig. It's called a pipeline inspection gauge. It's a robot. It's the only thing that ensures that these pipelines are safe and don't blow up and kill us. Don't, like the XL pipeline, don't spill all over and poison our aquifers for thousands of miles. It's the only thing we've got. In other words, they put this robot right into the pipe, and it goes with the oil or gas, and it beeps and boops when there's anything wrong. Corrosion, rust, it's too much pressure, a leak, a break, it's about to explode, it's about to leak or bust. It tells us. That's what they do. They just run through. It's very simple, except if the pig gets silenced so it doesn't squeal. And what one of the investigations I'm on, I find a guy we can only call Pig Man. And I speak to the others on his team as well, Pigman 1 and Pigman 2. There's a Pigman 3. And they are telling us that they are on the team which designed the software. And they tell us the software is fixed so that the pig doesn't squeal. And it's a violation of law. The law is very clear about you've got to shut down a pipe and replace the corroded, busted, leaking segments that the pig identifies. So what they do is it's just a lot cheaper to dial down the pig. It's like taking, you know what it is? It's like taking the battery out of your smoke detector. That's fine unless you have an actual fire. Same with the pig. And this is to save these guys billions and billions in pipeline replacement costs. The problem is the pig man came to me finally agreed to talk to me when 9 people were incinerated in California when a pipe burst and he knew the pig had run through that and didn't identify anything. That pipe was totally cracked, leaking, was ready to blow. And he said, it's no longer about software. It's about killing people.
And talking about killing people, Fukushima, this comes in too. Nuclear energy is something a lot of people say, well, we're going to go from oil to nuclear. I tell you, I'm shaking in my boots after reading this book, Vulture's Picnic, because it's just fundamental safety problems. Tell us what happened to Fukushima and why should we be scared right here?
See, it's not about inherent lack of safety in nuclear plant. I'm not anti-nuclear. I am anti-fraud and anti-crime. I was a fraud investigator. I directed the U.S. government's investigation of the big nuclear builder, Stoner Webster, many years ago. When I saw Fukushima melting down, I knew exactly what happened because the earthquake proofing failed. Oh, they said it was an earthquake we didn't expect. Well, it was a 9.0 earthquake. Yeah, it was a big earthquake in the middle of the ocean. By the time that shake got to Fukushima, it was a tenth of that power, a tenth, maybe 1% of that power that it was in the ocean. That plant should have stood. Why didn't it? Well, the answer is I go back into my files, and you can actually see in Vulture's Picnic the actual handwritten documents by the engineers. Every engineer keeps a little notebook that they fill in every day in a nuclear plant. They have to by rule and law. And we got the old notebooks, and I went back to 1988 files, and it says, "No way can this plant withstand an earthquake." That's a quote from the handwritten notes, and that the parts would, quote, utterly and completely fail in an earthquake. They knew, the company Stone & Webster, that design. Now, I took that to a jury. A jury found them guilty of fraud and racketeering, hit them for their co-conspirators for $4 billion. And Stone & Webster is saying, well, it's a happy ending. We can have good nuclear plants because they're out of business. Well, wait a minute. Stone & Webster changes shape and becomes a unit, the nuclear unit of Shaw Construction. The Obama administration has just approved 4 new nuclear plants. All 4, every one, will be built by Shaw Construction. This is the company that faked the earthquake proofing. And by the way, they got the contract to rebuild Fukushima. So don't sleep tight, because the problem is that it's so expensive to build a safe nuclear plant. Maybe you can build one, maybe you can't. But I can tell you this, if you do, it's untold billions to make it really safe, to make sure it can stand an earthquake. And an earthquake, by the way, it's a seismic event. That could also be, you know, a Valentine from Al-Qaeda that shakes the building. And the problem is that steel and cement and fraud are equal elements in building a nuclear plant.
Well, there's also the issue of the diesel generators, which, if anything, scared me even more. I mean, I live near the Vermont nuclear plant, which is right on the Connecticut River. We've got Millstone that's here. They're right by the water. You're saying these diesel generators can't get wet?
They can't get wet. And they don't work. These emergency diesel generators, as I find out from Diesel Man, another source, the problem is they don't work in emergencies. These are old. All these things, they look big, they sound noisy when they snap on, but they're old cruise ship engines that have been offloaded from cruise ships and stuck in these nuclear plants, and they are not meant to snap on in 12 seconds. When you cruise out to the Bahamas, they take a half hour to warm these things up in the bearings. So what happens? How come the diesel generators at Fukushima failed? And failed, by the way, at the Surrey nuclear plant just recently. The answer is they're not meant to snap on like that, to go up to full power in 12 seconds, which is what they're supposed to do. So it's a fake, but it's a cheap fake. They get these old diesels, and they fire them up, and they never test them. And so when we did a racketeering investigation, we required them to be tested. 3 engines at the Shoreham nuclear plant in New York. One failed in an hour, one failed in 2 hours, and one failed in 3 hours. It's a fake. It's to make you feel that you're covered if something goes wrong. At Fukushima, those diesels, could not handle any water at all, and they were not protected against water, which is crazy, because you protect your outdoor fixtures from water, right? And they don't do it with a nuclear plant. But even more important, most of those diesels actually didn't get wet. They committed suicide because when they were turned on, their crankshafts just went snap.
So in an emergency, these emergency diesel generators can't work.
Can't work. In other words, some may work, but the chances are, in every emergency we've had, most don't work. So you're in trouble because it is just there to pretend you're safe in case.
In this book, Vulture's Picnic, Greg Palast, we've covered maybe the tippy top of the tip of the iceberg. I want to ask you, you know, you call this pulp nonfiction. You have a kind of persona. I mean, you're a crack investigator. You've been an investigator all your life. Now an investigative journalist, have been so for a long time now as well. Why do you feel the need to kind of take on this persona of the, not a private eye, but kind of like a public eye?
Yeah, like Columbo is my. I think that I learned more about investigative reporting from Columbo than you could ever learn from the Columbia School of Journalism, which is not to take the official line. Don't buy it. This is who I am. In other words, I've had a certain way of approaching things forever. In fact, I'm known for wearing a fedora like Columbo, but I've actually worn a fedora for 40 years, and I didn't think about it till I went on television in Britain because I did an undercover investigation of the prime minister, and then the prime minister attacked me and said, never trust a man in a hat. At that point, BBC television said, you have to wear your hat all the time now because the prime minister attacked you for wearing it. So, but I'd wear it anyway because I don't have hair and I needed to keep the rain and sun off. But if you really do the work, if you do really, really serious work in investigating, and if you read Raymond Chandler's writing about investigators and real investigative reporters of the old style, when he wrote those stories of Philip Marlowe, they were based very, very much on real characters. If you're going to do real investigating, if you read Raymond Chandler, he based his character, Philip Marlowe, as he explained, on real investigators and real old-fashioned style investigative reporters that don't exist anymore. They used to be at the LA Times stuff. If you do real investigating, this is how it really works. It's much more real than you think. Now, it's a lot more boring in reality than the book shows or Raymond Chandler novel, because that's all compressed. And when I say boring, not for me. I love going through files and files and spending hours and hours and hours documents. So does Bad Penny. I mean, we just love numbers. We love going through old, dusty files. You go through the back alleys of Baku. And you have to understand, when you're on a stakeout, like I try to explain in the book how it's really done. When I'm on Democracy Now! Or BBC and you see me jump out of a car at some bad guy and shove the evidence in his face, or, you know, grab some, the president of Zambia or something like that, you just see that moment. What you don't see is sitting in the car for hours and hours and hours and hoping that you don't have to pee, and that the Dunkin' Donuts coffee is freezing on you, and then they're going to catch you. And I was just with Ricardo, my Gonzo cameraman last night, who's just taking off now for undercover work in Yemen and dangerous stuff. But we were talking about how lucky we were on our last vulture hunt that we didn't spend like 5 days waiting, hiding to just grab a glimpse of this guy. We got lucky. So it's a lot of work. And, you know, understand these targets, Goldfinger, he doesn't list himself in the phone book. Paul the Vulture Singer isn't going to talk to us. He's worth $4 billion and he owns the Republican Party.
And so how do you find them? Can you talk about how you found even one of these guys?
We use a lot of subterfuge. Whatever it takes, you know, we'll get some official detective agencies, so that will also help us get certain into databases legally. We don't break the law, but we do something that's just not done in the United States, which is real investigative reporting. We do go undercover. We will use false fronts. Again, we have to get that approved by the top levels at BBC. You know, I set up a big sting operation about with the big American power companies. As you know, if you read Vulture's Picnic, that I lose the James Bond award about once a week by making some really dumb, it doesn't seem dumb until afterwards, then you go, why did I do that? So I want people to also understand when I fail. And part of that is to understand, I want people to understand my personal failings in here, first time I kind of talk about my personal life, because I want people to understand I'm just like any other person. I just happen to be put in extraordinary circumstances with an extraordinary task. But I'm quite an ordinary guy.
And a risk-taking one, and thank God for that. Greg Pallast, your book is Vulture's Picnic. It is a terrific read. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. What a thrill to tell the story.
Greg Pallast is also the author of the New York Times bestseller Armed Madhouse and other books. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net. To find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.